Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, and welcome to a new series, My Book of the Week. In these podcasts, I'll be talking to the author of the book that has most excited me over the last 7 days. My guest today is Hilary Mantel, whose new novel, Wolf Hall, absolutely fulfills those criteria for me. And it's getting the sort of plaudits that most writers only dream of. Hilary, you must be a very happy woman this morning.
It's gratifying. You've no idea how nervous I was last week.
And it's a return to historical fiction. You've written memoirs. You're also a very busy critic. And what, you've written about 9 novels, have you?
This is my 10th. Mostly contemporary novels, but I've written 2 historical novels, one about the French Revolution and one set in Ireland and England, also at the end of the 18th century. So to go back to the Tudors was a big jump backwards for me.
We'll talk a bit about your fascination with the Tudors. But first, just to give a sense of the atmosphere of this novel, I wonder if you could read us a little bit from the opening chapter. This is the introduction to the main character of Wolf Hall, who is Thomas Cromwell, who is the right-hand man to Henry VIII.
And this is Putney, where Cromwell was born in the year, and we're in the year 1500, and he's about 15 years old. And the other player in the scene is his father, a blacksmith. So now get up. Felled, dazed, silent, he's fallen, knocked full length on the cobbles of the yard. His head turned sideways. His eyes are turned towards the gate, as if someone might arrive to help him out. One blow, properly placed, could kill him now. Blood from the gash on his head, which was his father's first effort, is trickling across his face. Add to this, his left eye is blinded. But if he squints sideways with his right eye, he can see that the stitching of his father's boot is unravelling. The twine has sprung clear of the leather, and a hard knot in it has caught his eyebrow and opened another cut. So now get up. Walter is roaring down at him, working out where to kick him next. He lifts his head an inch or two and moves forward on his belly, trying to do it without exposing his hands, on which Walter enjoys stamping. What are you, an eel? His parent asks. He trots backwards, gathers pace, and aims another kick. It knocks the last breath out of him. He thinks it may be his last. His forehead returns to the ground. He lies waiting for Walter to jump on him. The dog Bella is barking, shut away in an outhouse. I'll miss my dog, he thinks. The yard smells of beer and blood. Someone is shouting down on the river bank. Nothing hurts, or perhaps it's that everything hurts because there's no separate pain that he can pick out, but the cold strikes him just in one place, just through his cheekbone as it rests on the cobbles. Look now, Walter bellows. He hops on one foot as if he's dancing. Look what I've done. Burst my boot kicking your head. Inch by inch forwards. Never mind if he calls you an eel or a worm or a snake. Head down. Don't provoke him. His nose is clotted with blood and he has to open his mouth to breathe. His father's momentary distraction at the loss of his good boot allows him the leisure to vomit. That's right, Walter yells. Spew everywhere. Spew everywhere on my good cobbles. Come on, boy, get up. Let's see you get up. By the blood of creeping Christ, stand on your feet. Creeping Christ, he thinks. What a way to put it. His head turns sideways. His hair rests in his own vomit. The dog barks. Walter roars. And bells peal out across the water. He feels a sensation of movement, as if the filthy ground has become the Thames. It gives and sways beneath him. He lets out his breath, one great final gasp. You've done it this time, a voice tells Walter. But he closes his ears, or God closes them for him. He is pulled downstream on a thick black tide.
Well, as you can see from that opening, Thomas is what, if he were to have lived in the 21st century, would be called an abused child. But of course, there's no such thing at the time that he's living.
Oh, no, I think it would be regarded as all perfectly reasonable. But the result of this beating from his father is that he thinks, the next time Walter tries to do this to me, I'm going to kill him.
Do we know this about Thomas Cromwell? How much do we know? We usually only know about the history of rich and the famous.
OK, his family is very obscure. The only reason we know anything about them is that Walter was always in court. He was violent and he was a drunk. And we do know that round about the time he was 15, Cromwell made himself scarce. He got out of the country. Some people said later he was in trouble with the law himself. It may be so. All he ever said was, I was a ruffian in my youth. But he seems to have crossed the channel and joined the French army. So he was a mercenary. I guess he thought if he was going to fight, he may as well be paid for it.
So we first meet him as a 15-year-old being kicked to bits on the streets of London. And the next time we see him, he's really already rather successful. His rise is very, very quick.
Well, there are these lost years. He's been with the French armies. He's fought with them in Italy. And then somehow he pops up in northern Italy and he's sighted in Venice and in Rome. And he's working for the Italian merchant banks. We don't know how he picked up his education. He then surfaces in the Low Countries as a wool trader and comes back to London, takes to the law, marries well, joins Gray's Inn, sets himself up as a lawyer and goes to work for Cardinal Wolsey. Now, Wolsey is it. He is the other king. He is the man who's running the country while King Henry is hunting and chasing girls.
Now, Wolsey is, in some senses, structurally, is actually an attendant character upon the character of Thomas Cromwell, who's the protagonist. But I get the feeling that you're a little bit in love with this man. He sort of runs away with the first third of the book.
Oh, yes. Wolsey is such an absolute charmer. He has such charisma. And once I heard him talk, as it were, I wanted to hear what else he got to say. But I also became very aware how important he was in Cromwell's life. Not just the fact that the cardinal made his career, but also an emotional attachment.
Just tell me a little bit about why you are so fascinated with this period. I mean, it must be one of the most written about periods in English history.
Oh, yes, it's our national soap opera. But everything's in here. Epic themes and intimate themes. Lust for power. Lust for flesh. High politics. High thinking. Low plotting. It's got everything.
Sex.
Absolutely, yes. And also, I mean, interestingly, it's one of those periods which women really become players. The body politic becomes the woman's body, because the great problem of Henry's reign is who's going to give him this male baby, this heir he needs to succeed him. So sexual politics are at the centre of the court. But having said that, there's a huge amount of received opinion, a huge amount of prejudice in the way we view it, and these packets of prejudice have been passed on from one popular historian and novelist to the next. If you look at it from Thomas Cromwell's point of view, it's instantly defamiliarised.
I'd like at this point for you to read another little passage, which is, I think, shows how brave this novel is in sort of challenging some of those very myths you're talking about. And this is when Thomas Cromwell goes to dinner with Thomas More, who, of course, we all think of as the sainted, the one, he of the hair shirts and absolute probity. But your view of him is completely different.
In Thomas More's Great Hall, the conversation is exclusively in Latin, though More's wife Alice is their hostess and doesn't have a word of it. It is their custom to read a passage of scripture by way of grace. It's Meg's turn tonight, Moore says. He is keen to show off his darling daughter. She takes the book, kissing it. Over the interruptions of the fool, she reads in Greek. Gardiner sits with his eyes shut tight. He looks not holy, but exasperated. He, Cromwell, watches Margaret. She's perhaps 25. She has a sleek, darting head, like the head of the little fox, which Moore says he has tamed. All the same, he keeps it in a cage for safety. The servants come in. It's Alice's eye they catch as they place the dishes. Here, madam, and here. The family in Holbein's picture don't need servants, of course. They exist just by themselves, floating against the wall. Eat, eat, says Moore. All except Alice, who will burst out of her corset. At her name she turns her head. That expression of painful surprise is not native to her, Moore says. It's produced by scraping back her hair and driving in great ivory pins to the peril of her skull. She believes her forehead is too low. It is, of course. Alice, Alice, he says, remind me why I married you. To keep house, father, Meg says, in a low voice. Yes, yes, Moore says. A glance at Alice frees me from the stain of concupiscence.
Ouch! What I love about that passage is how economical it was. There are so many things going on in it, while at the same time it's just a picture of a family dinner. One thing, of course, is that it's a deconstruction of a picture that is familiar picture by Holbein.
Yes, Holbein's idyllic picture of the Moore family gathered together is hanging on the wall behind them. Absolute family solidarity and charm. But in front of Thomas Cromwell, the actual people at the table are tearing each other apart.
And you get an awful lot of this, the juxtaposition of very closely observed personal stuff with grand politics, all happening at the same time.
Well, you see, I think when two men are in a room having a political argument, let's say, they're bringing into that room with them all their personal past, all their hinterland, all their psychological hang-ups, all their preconceptions. There's always much more going on than what you hear and see on the top surface. And I've tried to get a sense of this in the novel, that Cromwell, through whose eyes we're seeing, is at any one moment beset not just by knowledge of what's going on around him, but by a wash of sense impressions, by the inroads of memory. There are always six things going on in that head. Or being Thomas Cromwell, there are 12 things going on in his head.
So, for example, he's thinking about what the household are going to eat at the same time as he's thinking about how he's going to manage Anne Boleyn at the same time as he's thinking about what's going to happen to Wolsey.
The Spanish ambassador described Cromwell as talking to you and looking at you intently all the time, his eyes fixed on your face, to work out what you were making of what he was telling you.
There's a lovely passage which I'd also like you to read, if you wouldn't mind, where he puts the thumbscrews on Harry Percy, and he represents an old aristocracy as opposed to Cromwell's more modern business-like form of governance.
Yes, Harry Percy has turned up in London with the embarrassing news that he believes he is really married to Anne Boleyn. Cromwell has pursued this harmless, rather feeble and very hungover young man to an inn called Mark and the Lion. He walks into a back room, slams the serving hatch and stands by while Harry Percy gabbles. He hears him out, the slide and tumble into incoherence. True love, pledges, swore she would give her body to me, allowed me such freedom as only a betrothed woman would allow. My lord, Cromwell says, you said what you have to say, now listen to me. You are a man whose money is almost spent. I'm a man who knows how you've spent it. You're a man who's borrowed all over Europe. I'm a man who knows your creditors. One word from me and your debts will be called in. Oh, and what can they do, Percy says? Bankers have no armies. Neither have you armies, my lord, if your coffers are empty. Look at me now. Understand this. You hold your earldom from the king. Your task is to secure the north. Percy's and Howard's between them. Defend us against Scotland. Now, suppose Percy cannot do it. Your men will not fight for a kind word. They're my tenants, Harry Percy says. It's their duty to fight. But, my lord, they need supply, they need provision, they need arms. They need walls and forts in good repair. If you cannot ensure these things, you're worse than useless. The king will take your title away, and your land, and your castles, and give them to somebody who can do the job that you cannot. He will not, the boy says. He respects all ancient titles, all ancient rights. Then let's say I will. Let's say I will rip your life apart, me and my banker friends. How can he explain to him? The world is not run from where he thinks, not from his border fortresses, not even from Whitehall. The world is run from Antwerp, from Florence, from places Harry Percy has never imagined, from Lisbon, from where the ships with sails of silk drift west and are burned up in the sun. Not from castle walls, but from counting houses. Not by the call of the bugle, but by the clink of the abacus. Not by the grate and clink of the mechanism of the gun, but by the scrape of the pen on the page of the promissory note that pays for the gun and the gunsmith and the powder and the shot. I picture you without money and title, he says. I picture you in a hovel, wearing homespun, and bringing home a rabbit for the pot. I picture your lawful wife, Anne Boleyn, skinning and jointing this rabbit. I wish you every happiness.
Partly what I think is fascinating about that passage is how modern it seems. Now, how on earth do you find the tone and the language to portray something that is so foreign to us and yet is somehow so familiar?
Well, I don't like pastiche language because it attracts attention to itself. What I wanted to do was get a flavour of Tudor English, of its rhythm and thump. And it's a very powerful and very vigorous idiom. But rather than making a big deal of language, I'm just trying to give them, not to give them thoughts they couldn't have had. And I've done the only thing you can do, really. I've read a lot of letters. And within these parameters, I've had to, of course, distinguish between my high and my low characters, and Cromwell, who very neatly bridges the gap and can talk to anyone in their own idiom and in one of many languages also.
It just struck me that, in a way, it is a book for today. It's a subject for today, isn't it? He represents the globalised economy, in a way.
Yes, Cromwell's a man who understands money. He doesn't just know how to count it, he knows how to make it work. He understood economics, then a science in its infancy. And the thing, I suppose, that fascinates me about him is what fascinated his contemporaries. Where does he come from? What does he know? Who's he met? What's he done in these lost years? I'm fascinated by a character who comes out of obscurity, bursts through all these rigid barriers of rank, and establishes himself as a player on the European stage.
But then from there, his fall is equally precipitous, and this is going to come in the sequel, is that right?
In the sequel, which I believe will be called The Mirror and the Light. I'll take Cromwell through his next 5 years to his heights of power, and then his somewhat mysterious and very sudden fall from grace, and his appointment with the headsman.
And then his final appointment with a spike on the walls of the City of London.
London Bridge, yes.
Hilary Mantel, I can't wait, and congratulations for Wolf Hall.
Thank you.